Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What propels a society to greatness, and what cuts it back down again? From ancient Mesopotamia to the Roman Empire to the New World Dominion of the Mayans, powerful and complex empires have arisen in times and places where food was abundant, then inevitably fallen into devastating decline as demand outpaced supply. So what does that portend for the 21st century, when the world is growing more food than ever before, but more than a billion of us exist without enough to eat, and climate change threatens to increase the challenges of producing adequate nutrition? Evan D.G. Fraser is adjunct professor of geography at the University of Guelph and senior lecturer in the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds. His new book, written with Andrew Remus, is called Empires of Food: Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Evan, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to hear your voice.
Historians have filled libraries writing about political crises and wars and economic collapse. How did you come to realize that food was actually at the heart of the rise and then the decline of every empire in human history?
Well, Andrew and I wrote an earlier book about cows and beef and a cultural history of steak and ice cream. And when we were researching that book 3 or 4 years ago now, we just came across this seemingly repeating pattern in history that civilizations seem to rise up when the climate's nice and the soils are fertile, and that provides an abundant surplus of food that supports people living in cities. And then eventually the soils erode away and the climate changes and the cities go away as well. And it just struck us as we were just beginning to think about these issues that the way modern Western 21st century society feeds itself is in a structural sense, not technological sense, but in a structural sense, very, very similar to the way the Romans fed themselves before the collapse of the Roman Empire, or the medieval civilization in Western Europe fed itself before the very, very unpleasant 14th century. And it just struck us that there were too many parallels between today and these past examples to be purely coincidence. And that's what led us to write this book.
And in every case, there's been this assumption that what works today will work tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of get used to the good times and adapt to or create a system that is based on the good times. And by the good times, I mean the sun in just the right amounts, the rain falling at just the right times, the soil having abundant nutrients. And we get used to the sort of the harvests we can obtain during the good times with very little awareness that there are inevitably bad times.
What's so interesting about this issue, Evan, is that at least in the developed West, we tend to think of food production as a challenge we figured out, we solved a long time ago, as opposed to a sort of threat looming on the horizon. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this is the really critical thing, that because, largely speaking, since the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, the West has enjoyed extremely good weather. Broadly speaking, up until the last 10 years, we've had extremely good weather over the latter half of the 20th century. We've also managed to erase or mask the problems of soil erosion by applying fertilizers. But there, all we're doing is swapping our dependency on soil nutrients for our dependency on fossil fuels, because to synthesize nitrogen, which is the main thing that plants need when they're growing, to create nitrogen, you need a huge amount of natural gas to create those fertilizers. So we swapped our dependency from a natural process onto an industrial one. And this has created the illusion that we have uncoupled ourselves or unhitched our trailer from nature. In reality, and the argument that we advance in our book is that we've just postponed that inevitable reckoning and made it potentially all the worse because we've grown such an enormous population as a result of these things.
And in that population, there's the extraordinary irony of obesity and hunger coexisting globally on an unprecedented scale.
Yeah, well, this is one of the deep ironies of modern life. And there's a Nobel Prize-winning economist named Amartya Sen who said that it's not that hunger in the modern world is any worse or famine is any worse, but it's much more morally reprehensible because it's ultimately preventable, because we do, at the moment, have enough food to feed everybody. However, I'm concerned that as we look to a future where many expect the weather not to be as good as it has been over the past 50 years, and many expect the price of oil to be much more expensive than we've enjoyed over the last 50 years, that we are going to start running out of food. We're not going to have the kind of superabundance we've enjoyed for the last 50 years. And that's going to force us, whether it's by providence and by sensible management, or by panic and famine, it's going to force us to change the way we get our food.
So the assumption that once we figure this out in terms of distribution and wealth management and sort of sharing the world we're able to produce today, once we figure that out, we will have solved hunger once and for all. Is that naive?
I think so, in a sense. I mean, it's a wonderful aspiration, and it's one that I personally subscribe to. That said, I think as we look to a future where best guesses are we're going to end up with about 9 billion of us on the planet sometime in the next 50 years, best guesses that about two-thirds of those people are going to probably live in cities. Best guesses are that probably the climate will not be as advantageous for producing crops, and that the soil will be in worse shape and fertilizer will be much more expensive to spread. You put all those factors together, and a fellow by the name of John Beddington, who's the UK government's chief scientific advisor, says we're facing a perfect storm in the next 50 years of this collision of factors all coming together. And so at that point, we're going to have to be very careful about how food is distributed around the world such that we don't send off massive famines and waves of migration and whatnot.
And as we've seen in the past couple of years, when shortages do occur, the first to suffer are almost always those who were already the least secure.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's actually, some of the poorest people are actually not as bad off as some of the almost poorest. So there's sort of a section of the population that's just above, globally speaking, that's just above the poorest, which are the most vulnerable to these things. And these are people that, say, may have abandoned traditional agricultural practices and just begun the process of modernizing their farms, or have just started to send relatives into the city to start working. And we're talking rural Africa, countries like Malawi. And it's the not quite so poor that are the most vulnerable to these shocks, because they don't have the traditional diversified agricultural systems that are actually quite robust to climate changes. Because they have a lot of diversity and because they're quite labor-dependent. Those are fairly robust systems. They're very, very poor systems, but they're quite robust systems. Whereas as people start getting a little bit richer, as they send the first few relatives into the city and lose the rural labor, as they maybe specialize their farms to make a bit of cash, it's those communities that are actually the very most vulnerable to shocks.
So let's go back into our history for a bit here. Talk about how food surplus has played into the growth of empires.
Yeah, well, I mean, probably the most classic and obvious example of that is the Roman Empire, which supported, with very primitive technology, supported an enormously vibrant urban population that had nothing to do with producing food. They had no involvement with agriculture whatsoever. And the only reason that was possible, the only reason cities are ever possible, is because the farmers are producing more food than they need, and there's a surplus of food that can then be transported to the cities. So the Roman Empire was entirely based around the long-term the production of surplus wheat in particular, but wheat, olive oil, and some fish products. Wine as well was another very important surplus product. And then storing it and transporting it to get into these major cities, of which, of course, the city of Rome was the most impressive. And it was probably a million people at its peak in a fairly small geographic area. So there was an extremely densely packed urban population that was very cosmopolitan, that had access to foodstuffs from around the world. It would be a very familiar scene, food-wise, to modern eaters, I think.
So where did things go wrong for the Romans?
Well, I mean, the Romans ended up growing large and abundant during a period of time when, A, the soil was fairly fertile, and, B, the climate was agreeable. And the period of time that was sort of the peak of the Roman Empire is known by paleoclimatologists. These are people that study past weather patterns and use computer models and a whole bunch of very sophisticated scientific methods to anticipate or reconstruct past weather patterns. This was a period of time known as the Roman Warm Period, when the Roman Empire expanded dramatically. Now, as it expanded, it tended to work its soils into exhaustion, and that was one of the impulses or impetuses behind increasing the expansion of the Roman Empire, was to seek additional grain fields. And so in the Republican period, before the Roman Empire, well, it was still a republic, the war against Carthage on the south coast of the Mediterranean was largely about access to fertile wheat fields. Rome ended up winning that one. They ended up winning the the battles with the Egyptians, or forming alliances with the Egyptians to get access to the Nile Basin, which is extremely fertile. But then it couldn't sustain itself. It had expanded itself to such an extent that the cost of keeping this global system going was very expensive. The soil was eroding and yields were declining, and then the climate changed, and the Roman warm period came to an end, ushering in a very cold, difficult 400 or 500 year period from around 300 to around 800 or 900, and the system simply could not sustain itself. So as the agriculture collapsed, the tax revenue collapsed. It was too expensive to maintain the legions out in the periphery. The trading route stopped, and with the trading route stopping, then places like Rome couldn't get its food anymore. And so Rome, over about a 100-year period, dropped by about half in terms of its population. And it's expected that, generally speaking, Europe lost about half of its population between 300 and 500 AD.
And a lot of that happened, there was starvation and disease, but there was also a lot of violence over this time.
Yeah. So as the center superpower is struggling against these economic problems, so declines in yields causes inflation, gets very expensive to maintain these legions out on the periphery, opportunistic neighbors, known to the Romans as the barbarians or the Visigoths, start getting aggressive. They see easy pickings. The whole political and environmental and economic system, which is all actually linked together as one big system, just starts eroding, and these barbarian tribes around the edges figure it's time to exert some autonomy. And yes, it became a very uncomfortable period of time to live in.
And I guess the Romans could be forgiven for failing to predict that the climate was going to change significantly, but the same couldn't be said about us today.
Well, here's the thing, right? Although we debate the computer models and the veracity of the science, the safe bet is that the climate models are pretty good most of the time, and that the community of scientists that are working on this are pretty good most of the time, and that chances are things are going to get a little bit uncomfortable for us in the next 150 years. We don't have to rely on omens to tell the weather like the Romans did. We can rely on pretty sensible scientific understanding. So this is a case where we have the leg up on all of the ancient civilizations, is that we can see the problem coming, we can stare down the barrel at it, and we can hopefully have the wisdom to be proactive about it all and plot ourselves a different course.
Is anybody taking steps to do this, or do you find that people are still sort of standing around waiting for the first shock?
Well, there's nothing like a shock to focus people's attention. So in 2008, I think the world food system stepped very close to a very uncomfortable place. Mm-hmm. And so between 2000 and 2008, we generally speaking ate a fair bit more than we produced. And the world was dipping into some pretty serious deficits in terms of its grain reserves leading up to 2008. Then 2008, oil prices shot up, if you recall. And the oil prices, because of our use of fossil fuel fertilizers, oil prices and food prices are quite linked. Also linked into this was the bioethanol industry, which created this new demand for corn. Instead of eating it, we wanted to put it in our gas tanks. And all that together meant food prices more or less tripled over about an 18 to 24-month period. And major economies of this world got very, very concerned. India stopped exporting. The IMF declared a crisis. The UN declared a crisis. At any rate, we ended up with a problem. Luckily, the climate agreed with us, and harvest in 2008 came in, and we actually did pretty well. So that took the pressure off.
Evan D.G. Fraser is my guest. He's adjunct professor of geography at the University of Guelph and senior lecturer in the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds. We're talking this hour about his new book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Evan D.G. Fraser. We're talking about his new book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. You mentioned, Evan, that between 2000 and 2008, we were often eating more than we produced. One of the concerns you have is that in the modern world, we don't do a very good job at storing food in the event of an emergency down the road.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think that I think that in order to protect ourselves against future production shocks, the world needs to get back into the habit of storing more food, which is expensive. It's complicated. Food goes bad, so you can't store it indefinitely. So if you don't end up needing it because there isn't a production shock, it's perceived as wasteful because you end up then throwing spoiled food out of big silos. But there's a very sad story that came out of the poor country of Malawi, southeastern Africa, about 10 years ago. And after many years of not having a famine, Malawi had a famine, and it also had a UN-sponsored thing called the Strategic Grain Reserve that was supposed to hold on to large amounts of grain and release it into the market when food prices rose because there wasn't enough food, and this would bring prices down and give people a buffer until their harvest came in. And when Malawi went into a famine early around the year 2000, 2001, they opened the silos, and the silos were empty. Mm. And the silos were empty for two reasons. One, not proven but almost certainly true, there was a lot of corruption, and the food had been stolen. Two, the International Monetary Fund had adopted a policy a few years earlier of encouraging countries to release food from their strategic grain reserve, to sell the food off onto the market, which in the eyes of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was more efficient economically because food storage is expensive, and the argument was it was better to sell the food that you had, invest the money in whatever, and then buy food off of the market when you were in shortfall. Now, that didn't work in Malawi's case, and they had a fairly significant famine in those years. The world has to get, in my opinion, back into the business of having strategic grain reserves, not just in places like Africa, but also bigger silos and more of an infrastructure to store food in North America as well.
The irony there, again, is that, yes, it's expensive and it's labor-intensive, but we're really good at it in the modern world. We know how to keep things good for some time through a variety of technologies that weren't available to our ancestors.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a technological question. It's an engineering question, one which we have the know-how to overcome. If the Romans could store an annual harvest from Egypt, you know, the Egyptian wheat harvest only came in once a year, and that was the majority of the majority of the food the citizens of the city of Rome ate. So they had to store wheat for a year's time in these enormous silos called horaria. Similarly, if you go back to the Old Testament, the Pharaoh of Egypt said that had a dream where he dreamt there were skinny cows being eaten by fat cows. And the interpretation of the dream was the skinny cows were the famine and the fat cows were the good years. And the advice that Joseph from the Old Testament hero gave to the Pharaoh was store a bit of food every year. In other words, tax your farmers about a fifth of their harvest, and then that will give you enough of a buffer to survive the bad times. We can do this. There's no technological question. We can do this. The ancient Egyptians did it. The ancient Romans do it. We could do it much more efficiently. But for economic reasons, we choose not to. And I think the reason we don't choose to is because the last 50 years, we've generally speaking been able to eat year to year without any problem at all. It's only when we look into the future of 9 billion people, climate change, increased soil erosion, high oil prices, that we consider the costs of food storage as being pretty acceptable and actually quite small relative to the cost of not having food storage in a year when things go bad.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Larry in North Dallas. Hello, Larry.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Malthus, in the 19th century, wrote that food increases arithmetically, population geometrically. And what I see, just yesterday, Iran announced that it was abolishing birth control, and they want a big population. We have similar pressures here, from religious groups. what happens if we just keep reproducing? It'll be beyond 9 billion, because now population is being used for political purposes, for domination. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thanks for your call. Evan, what do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting point, Ray. Larry, I beg your pardon. And you're right. Malthus, writing around the year 1800, Thomas Malthus, did say that its population growth will inevitably exceed or go faster than the ability of producing food. In actual fact, the last 200 years have proven Malthus wrong. And generally speaking, most places in the world have produced more food than their population has gone up. I'm worried that Malthus will ultimately be proven right and get the last laugh here. In the last 200 years, we have actually had an arithmetic or geometric increase, or exponential increase in the amount of food we've been producing. When it comes to population growth, it's interesting because you're right. In many parts of the world, it is a political, cultural tool. The demographers, however, have noted something very important, and that's in countries where the women traditionally have not been educated, as soon as you start introducing primary school education for young girls, you see very quickly, as soon as that generation of girls hits child-rearing ages, you see very quickly a decline in population growth. And it's that function. It's the effect of educating young girls in places in the world that traditionally didn't educate young girls, you actually see quite a dramatic tail off in population growth. And as a result of that, the population modelers figure we won't exceed 9 billion people. So places like U.S. and Canada, Western Europe, have more or less stopped growing through natural increases. And places that are still growing, where education is becoming available to young girls, are quickly tailing off. So the best guess is, we'll max out at around 9 billion. Probably the more significant thing is the number of people who are moving to cities, and specifically moving to cities in Asia and Africa.
It is interesting, though, Evan, that in the ancient world, at least, it seems as if population growth would sort of follow this food surplus. So if you had plenty of food, then there were more children born and surviving, and the population would grow. But the reverse doesn't seem to happen. When food supplies fall off, population doesn't adjust itself quickly or easily at all to the lack of food.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's easy to breed babies, and if you've got a full stomach, yes, you're absolutely right. So as specifically protein, as protein supplies go up, then people tend to have more people, and that's a rhythm of history that I don't think we can argue with. However, once you're alive and you're faced with declining food, you know, people tend to fight pretty hard to stay fed, and so there's a real strong momentum in society to keep people alive, both for moral reasons and for, if it's you that's starving, self-preservation reasons. So the implications of food declines are very, very serious.
We have an email here from Rollins in Dallas who asks if you would comment on how this research that you've done might explain some of the abandoned civilizations and cities like Easter Island and Machu Picchu.
Yeah, I don't know much about Easter Island. I'm aware that the Easter Island has been well documented by Jared Diamond in his book Collapse, so I'm not going to speak to that one. The one that I think is interesting from those abandoned civilizations are probably the Maya civilization, the Yucatan. So these are the cities of Palenque or Tikal, with the very famous roof comb temples that tower through the jungle. And the current archaeology thinks that they grew quite large, sort of 400 to 800 AD, roughly, when the Yucatan Peninsula was quite moist. And as they grew, they cut down all the rainforest around their cities and replaced them with cornfields. Now, there's two things went wrong here. First of all, when you take a rainforest, or specifically a tropical rainforest, and cut it down, the soil very quickly loses organic matter, which is important because the organic matter acts like a sponge and holds water. So a high organic matter soil is actually quite drought resistant because the soil stays the water stays in the soil and is available for the plants. Second problem was, around 800, there was a bad drought in the Yucatan Peninsula. And scientists know this by studying lake bottom sediments and the ocean floor and seeing what sort of dissolved minerals there are in the ocean floor and interpreting this sort of cores taken from lake bottoms as if they were tree rings and looking at where years when there was lots of dissolved sediments, probably high rainfall, not many dissolved sediments, low rainfall. And at exactly the time when the Mayan civilization packed up and abandoned their colossal cities was a bad drought. And so this bad drought happened, hit a food system that was already sensitive to drought because they'd lost their organic matter in their soils because of the clear cutting and the replacement of the forest with grain fields, and that society simply couldn't keep its urban citizens fed. The monumental structures stopped being built, the statues stopped being carved, and people probably died in large numbers. We'll never know that for sure, but one way or another, those cities stopped being viable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Next up, we'll go to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I don't really mean to challenge the general drift of what you're saying, but I did have a question. Earlier, you spoke of the decline of the Roman Empire as being due to climatic shocks that allowed the Visigoths to shake off the shackles under which they'd been and supplant the Romans in those areas where the Visigoths lived. But my question is, wouldn't the Visigoths have been subject to the same climatic shocks, and why were they able to weather those shocks better than the Romans?
Thanks for that.
That's a really excellent question, Ed, so I appreciate that. First of all, a caveat, it's always impossible to attribute something like the collapse of a civilization to a single problem, and there were multiple causes. So that's a bit of a dodge, I realize. Why, your specific answer to your question, why were the Visigoths able to adapt better to the climactic shock, was probably that they weren't involved in urban society quite so much. I mean, one of the things was that Rome's population had grown dependent on being able to ship food from Egypt, from Sardinia, from Spain, into the city of Rome. And when those yields declined, there was no buffer in that system. Whereas the Visigoths, who had a much lower population density, a much less urbanized culture, where much more of the population was directly involved in agriculture and food production, didn't have the same what the economists call an economic class, people like me, who sit around and think and talk but don't actually produce any food. The Visigoths, who would have had a much smaller economic class, much larger productive class of people, would not have had anywhere near the same problems. Similar thing probably happened when the Vikings hit Iceland and Greenland in the 1300s, medieval warm period. The Vikings were able to set up farms and homesteads in Greenland. They lived side by side with the Inuit for many years. Then the Little Ice Age hit. Things got colder. The Inuit were able to thrive just fine with their production system. The Vikings were completely unable to adapt to even a relatively small change in temperature, and those farmsteads just had to be completely abandoned.
Let's talk about corporate control of the contemporary food production system. You found some interesting analogies between the modern way of growing food and the errors of medieval Europe. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, medieval Europe's fascinating because from the fall of the Roman Empire, when Europe's population started picking up growth really quickly. You see a very steep increase in population between about 700-800 and 1300. And this corresponds with this medieval warm period where things are relatively good. It also corresponds with the rise of monasticism. These are the monks, specifically the Benedictine or Cistercian monks in Western Europe, that established extremely rich chapter houses. And these monks would go into a wilderness, plow an area, build a chapter house, create a nucleus around which a society or a settlement would form, and then they would specialize in producing cheese, say, from northern Italy, or beer, say, from the modern Czech Republic or whatnot. And they would trade these things across the length and breadth of Europe. And in doing so, they created so much wealth that by the late 1200s, Europe was building things like Notre Dame Cathedral. Enormous amount of wealth, enormous amount of ingenuity, creativity, cultural works. Oxford and Cambridge University are formed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the monks were the spearhead behind this cultural growth, and they did it because they controlled the means by which they produced food. They were the primary farmers, and in doing that, they also controlled the means by which food was processed. And this is where the analogy gets really important. because the monks were the only ones rich enough to hold on to the really big, new, heavy plows that were required to plow the deep soils of Northern Europe. They were the ones that turned the surplus wheat into beer or the surplus milk into cheese. They generally had monopolies on food retail, so you had to, if you were a merchant, you had to sell at a medieval fair, which was almost inevitably linked to a monastery where you were paying a rent. And so in many regards, food production, food processing, agricultural technology, and food retail, all of those functions were controlled by a small group of very well-organized corporated individuals. And there was one particular monastery that was called, based in a town of Cluny, that had essentially branch plants all across Europe and that would trade extensively, like I said, owned the means of production and the retail. And so they fulfilled all of the same functions as the modern agribusiness: control of production, inputs, technology, distribution, and retail. And in doing so, they created this enormously wealthy, advanced society, but they also created a system that was very, very brittle and unable to withstand the climate change that occurred around the 1300s.
So they essentially just didn't, once again, consider that something could turn out different than it had been in decades in the past.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. They created these highly specialized nodes that were unable to adapt when the yields became poor and the soils became eroded.
My guest this hour is Evan D.G. Fraser. He is adjunct professor of geography at the University of Guelph and senior lecturer in the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds. His new book, written with Andrew Remus, is called Empires of Food: Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. We'll resume our conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can join us by getting on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or shooting an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Evan D.G. Fraser. His new book is Empires of Food: Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. We'll go back to the phones now, and this time we're speaking with Harvey in Farmersville. Hi, Harvey.
How you doing, Chris?
Great,
Chris,
thank you.
I got a question for you about Rollins. When he emails something in, doesn't it just make you mad with that voice he's got?
I love Rollins' voice.
Isn't that... He's got the greatest voice in all of North Texas, at least, maybe all of Texas, which is, as we know, is a known world. And then he uses email. Makes you want to slap him.
Well, we'll encourage him to call next time.
Evan, I have to wonder, how did these climate changes and the food scarcity, how did that change the religious perspectives? Because I could see where when everything was good and there was plenty of bounty, that they had a different kind of God than they would have whenever times were hard and they were having to fight for what they could get. Is that historically correct?
Yeah, I think so. There, Harvey, right? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think that's absolutely bang on. So if you think of the period of time, say the 1300s, 1200s was pretty good. I would perfectly happy to have been alive during the 1200s. This is when Notre Dame was being built and all these huge, you know, Gothic cathedrals were going up in Europe. 1400s, on the other hand, were awful. So the first thing that happened was bad rains in the 13 teens created a famine that probably killed 15-20% of Europe. That sets off a wave of religious persecutions and migrant, you know, gangs sort of roaming the countryside, often aligning themselves with some vision of an apocalypse, some very extreme religious opinion. The pastoral movement in France in particular gets going and committed some horrible atrocities before the army of the King of France finally executed the whole lot of them. So there were thousands of people dying, and it was seen in the context. You have to see this in the context of people losing their ability to feed themselves and grabbing on to very, very extreme opinions in the hopes that provided some solution. I think the same thing happens in the mid 1600s with the wars of religion across Germany, the Protestants versus the Catholics. Again, this happens right at the Little Ice Age, the bottom peak of this cooling trough that starts in the 1400s, gets as bad as it gets in the mid 1600s, which is when basically Germany and areas around Germany kill, 30% of people ended up dying in a series of wars that, again, have to be seen in the context of very, very tough economic times where food was very, very scarce. Another manifestation of this was the witch hunts. And again, the witch hunts peak at this point in history, where society in Europe in the 1600s, I think, essentially became quite unhinged mentally. And a lot of the hysteria took the form of extreme religious views. As people were grasping for solutions to this extremely difficult set of circumstances they were in. Of course, these extreme opinions, I think, only exacerbated the problem. They forced people into further camps, and they actually turned what could have been a crisis that you could adapt to into a crisis that ultimately killed a third of the population of Europe in the case of the 1600s.
Something that you find really troubling in today's world is that in places where we can relatively easily feed ourselves, it's not enough to just put good nutrition into our bodies. Food has become a sort of fashion statement. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things about the modern world that both encourages me and makes me a little depressed. And this is the sort of the foodie movement, the group of people of which I belong to at times, that take an extraordinary amount of pleasure in the kind of food they eat. And at its most extreme form, that actually is a problem, and that we sort of prioritize the particular kind of mushroom or the particular artisanal cheese or whatnot over all other things, and it becomes essentially a fashion item. So that's the negative side, I think, of the foodie movement that Andrew and I in our book discuss under the tag of the new glutton. The positive side of this is that it's also about people getting educated about food and getting excited about food. And I think one of the things that we need to do in the modern society is engage in a cultural shift where people need to get as excited about food as we traditionally or typically get as excited about sports or fashion or some of these other things. And when we start getting as excited about food as say, football, I'm partly from England, so we've been spending a lot of time thinking about football recently. As soon as we start getting excited about food in the same sort of light, I think we'll start seeing a number of new solutions and alternative ways of getting food and eating food come to the fore. But if it takes the form of becoming excessively refined about food, then that becomes a problem. Way back when, Thomas Aquinas, one of the sort of medieval theologians, described gluttony not just as overeating, but also being excessively preoccupied with dainty food. And so in the modern world, we sort of aware that overeating is a problem. We also should be aware that being excessively excited about the particulars of food is a problem as well.
So when you talk about new ways of getting food, describe to us a nested food system.
Yeah, well, this is sort of the crux of the solution, I think. And that where I used to live in England, it's the Yorkshire Dales, and it's nice rolling hillsides. And that place makes ideal pasture, fabulous pasture. So for your lamb in particular, and for your beef, and to a certain extent for dairy products, you can get very, very good quality product. So I would not want the north of England to try to be self-sustaining in wheat. They should be self-sustaining in meat, but they should specialize in meat. But within this specialization on meat, you need to have a lot of diversity. So it's not just one uniform type of sheep or one uniform type of cow, but you've got to have a large number of different kinds of cows and sheep all across a fairly diversified landscape that's broken up with forests and hedgerows and stuff like that. Now, within that specialized area, though, you're going to have to do some trading with areas that have other specializations, like a dairy-producing area or a wheat-producing area. So we're not suggesting that every city needs to have a 100% buy-local scheme. What we're suggesting is that you need to have diversity within a specialized type of food in a region that then trades with other regions to get other sources. And that's what we call a nested bioregional approach.
So that if a terrible virus comes through and wipes out all of one type of sheep, then you're not completely lost.
You're not completely lost, exactly. So there's enough diversity to be protected. It's a lot like managing an investment portfolio. That's a sort of I was working with a banker a few years ago, and he kept going on about this. You know, if you think of your food system as a portfolio, and you want to be specialized in something because you don't want to. If everyone tries to do everything, we won't be very efficient at it. So you want to be specialized in something, but within that general area of specialism, you need a fair bit of diversity to protect yourself from risks. You also need to store food, and that's analogous to your cash reserves. So if some of your major investments go south, you're not left without anything to fall back on. You need some sort of cash reserves to bridge yourself over against a worst-case scenario. And it's that kind of metaphor that I think is helpful when we think about how we should design and a food system or what kind of food system we should be promoting.
Yeah, we had a show, a discussion a few months ago about bananas and the fact that about 95% of the bananas we can buy in this country are genetically identical to one another. And in fact, there is a pretty severe disease that could potentially wipe these kinds of bananas out across the globe.
Yeah, that's exactly a problem. That's exactly the issue we're talking about. And the classic historic example of this happening was the Irish potato famine, where not for issues of globalization, but issues of poverty, the Irish peasant found themselves needing to depend on one single variety of potato that was extremely productive, but was very, very homogenous. That was a very, from a landscape perspective, the west coast of Ireland in 1845 was one large potato field. The fields themselves were small, tight packed together without any margins. So that's a lot like a modern wheat field. And the potatoes that were in them were almost identical. Not genetically identical, that's a benefit we have of modern plant breeding, but they were very, very similar. And as a result, there was no ability, no resistance in that system to withstand a bug, in the Irish case, the pathogen that caused the potato blight. Exactly. Bananas, very, very similar situation. Wheat's not all that different. We have very few varieties of wheat that are commonly planted. Soybeans, same. Rice, again, we've specialized our production onto such highly efficient, highly productive cultivars, varieties of these plants, but there's no variety in them. And so a bad bug that slips past our chemical cocktails or chemical barriers that's supposed to keep the bugs gone will have the potential to cause enormous problems for world food production.
Given that this is obviously an issue of national and international security, if things get really bad, do you feel like world leaders are paying enough attention to the potential for a crash like the one you've described?
The short answer is no. I think where you see interesting things happening, at least in North America, tends to be at the municipal level, for food policy institutes, food policy councils. There's a lot of cities in Canada and the U.S. that are now hosting food policy councils as part of municipal government, which have a mandate to do these sort of things. In Ontario, there's a lot of emphasis right now on greenbelt legislation, which protects farmland around the city of Toronto, for example. So I'm seeing the most interesting governance policy kind of developments actually at a much smaller scale and very, very little attention, broadly speaking, at a national or international scale.
Why do you think they haven't paid more attention at a macro scale?
Well, I think it's because we've been lulled into a false sense of complacency given our cheap oil and decent weather over the last 50 mm-hmm. years. And as a result of that, it's never been perceived as urgent at a national scale because we've always been able, at least in the West, to buy food in whenever any modest problems have occurred. But there haven't been any big problems. We came close in 2008, but the weather then cooperated with us. We got when the harvest in 2008 came in, it was a world record. Climate was good, and the heat went off the crisis. However, as we look forward into the future, we can't expect the weather to bail us out whenever we get into a problem.
By some estimates, food production will need to double within 20 years to support population projections. Is that possible based on the way we're doing things now?
It would be hard. I mean, if we plowed a lot more land, and there's still land available, but it tends to be quite marginal. So if we started plowing marginal land up, then we could get a boost. If we get some as yet unrealized genetically modified miracle, we could probably do quite well. But again, we're going to be facing some very, very fundamental constraints with regard to nitrogen in particular, phosphorus in particular, and water again. So these are the inputs. And if you got a super abundant plant that's going to be producing this doubling of yield, you're going to need twice as much water, twice as much nitrogen, twice as much potassium. And these are not things which are easy to come by. Potassium in particular, we have no ability to create that in a factory. Nitrogen, we can turn natural gas into nitrogen. It's extremely expensive energy-wise, but we can do it. We are completely dependent on natural phosphorus. So I think there's a couple very critical choke points in our ability to try to double world food production.
And, of course, aside from even synthetic fertilizers, there's the question of our dependence on fossil fuels for the energy they provide in growing and harvesting our crops.
Yeah, so we are, at every step of the way, we are dependent on a fossil fuel-soaked system to provide us with our daily bread. And in many regards, thanks to our ability to synthesize nitrogen, our daily bread is a product of fossil fuel. So before 1930, the world's nitrogen had to come through natural sources and come to plants through natural sources. Since the 1930s, increasingly we are putting chemical nitrogen onto plants. And there's nothing in terms of health that's wrong with that, but it does mean that even the molecules we eat are coming out of a fossil fuel-based process as opposed to a natural one.
So is the next major collapse of the food system inevitable, or is it something that we possess the power to prevent?
Well, if you think of what happened in 2008, where a tripling of the world's prices occurred over an 18-month period, roughly, I think that sort of shock is inevitable. I don't know when it'll happen, because it will depend on a collision of environmental, climatological, and economic factors. Does a tripling of the world's food prices have to lead to the collapse of Western civilization? No, it absolutely doesn't. We are fully capable of, theoretically, of adapting to these sort of problems. I grew up on a farm. When I was 17, my grandfather was in his mid-70s, and we had a bad drought. And my grandpa and another guy and I spent a week, piling up, saving the crops. It was a very moving irrigation pipes around, piling up little piles of dirt around every single corn plant so that they wouldn't fall over in the hot, crumbly soil. And at the end of the year, the harvest was fine. 10 years later, I was living with my girlfriend in the city. My grandfather was in his late 80s. A similar drought happened. The corn crop fell over because my grandfather did not have the ability to adapt at that point in his life. It's that kind of story at a big scale.
Evan D.G. Fraser's new book is called Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Evan, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.